Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt, and today I'm very happy to have with me Scott Turow. He's the author, most recently, of Personal Injuries, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. He made his fictional debut with Presumed Innocent, followed by The Burden of Proof, Pleading Guilty, and The Laws of Our Fathers. Now, I find these books to be remarkable because while they are full of the legal machinations for which they've become famous, their real subject, it seems to me, has to do with the way the legal procedure represents or misrepresents the depth of character underneath the procedures. In this case, we have a main character, Robbie Faver, spelt F-E-A-V-E-R, sometimes pronounced even by him, fever, and he is a liar. Now, we all know that lying from the stands leaves one legally culpable, but this book is ultimately about why a person would lie and what might make him morally enviable, or at least not judgeable, because of his behavioral deficits. Now, where did this character come from? How did you build him?
Robbie Faver's most direct literary ancestor is the whiskey priest in Graham Greene's The Power and the Glory, which was a novel that sort of levitated me from my bed in my college dorm first taught me about moral complexity in characters. I had the idea, I have autobiographical antecedents in this book. I was an assistant United States attorney involved for many years in a huge investigation of judicial corruption, which is indeed the subject matter of Personal Injuries. But in terms of where I wanted to go as a novelist, it was not my prosecutorial experience, but my experience 22 years now as a criminal lawyer on both sides. And as I say, The Power and the Glory seemed to me to be the place to start.
Now, many listeners don't know, or if they do, they forget, that you were a writer before you thought of becoming a lawyer, and that it was when more or less facing a lot of rejection as a writer that you decided to go to law school, that you found your subject
right.
for fiction,
right.
and that these books in that way, as a result, come with much greater complexity, literary, moral, as well as technical, than they otherwise would. Now, this book seems to me to be the most complexly plotted in a certain way of all of them, least involved in a legal trick or a secret, but really about opening up the moral turf of loyalty and friendship
right.
that holds not the courtroom together, but holds life together.
Right.
So the question is about violating friendship
right.
in order to uphold the law or pay token recognition of the
right.
law. Now, this becomes, I think it's reflected on all the levels of your writing. The writer is side by side with the lawyer. It's almost as if the teller, the plumber of moral depths of people is sitting in arbitration with a lawyer, and they're doing an arm wrestle in your books, and the question will always be, what will win?
Mm-hmm.
Morality or monkey shines, legalisms?
Well, I regard, as you have suggested, Michael, all of these novels as written to a single theme. It was Green who indeed suggested that every writer at some level writes only one book. And to me, that theme is exactly what you mentioned, that the, first of all, the sort of nobility of the law in the sense that civilization depends upon some effort to define those aspects of our social conduct which have to be condemned. And that's a necessary line drawing. But the fact, of course, is that the law is, which in that line drawing tries to pretend that it is an accurate representation of our social existence. It's completely inadequate to that task, and thus the law's categories, although necessarily drawn, never, no matter how tight, can never confine the real complexity of human nature. And, you know, a character like Robbie Favor completely hops out of his box. I mean, he escapes the reader's expectations, I hope. That was certainly the intent.
Now, the book seems to have a constant interest in not only who we are, but who we aren't.
Mm-hmm.
And so the FBI agent assigned to him mirrors him in that she, too, has a name, a made-up name in this case, that can be mispronounced. It looks like Yvonne, but she pronounces it even. And she was in life an Olympic athlete. She's wrestling with questions about her sexuality, her inclination to be attracted to other women. And in this case, it's an inclination that has only been occasionally acted upon,
right.
At least so it seems. So at every level, we're dealing with people who are presenting a different aspect of themselves than the one that can be seen. As someone who definitely wears two hats, writer and lawyer, and I assume family man as well, to what extent does that kind of, not exactly deception, but false face wearing or multiple masks enter your life, and how is it reflected in the writing?
Well, Robbie's point of view, is that everybody is a con to one degree or another. And in his usual infuriating way, he is both uses that as an excuse for his plainly egregious behavior. and at the same time, the fact is he's onto something, for that is indeed true of all of us. Indeed, at one point, he expresses what I think is probably for me a sincere idea that we are in this sort of hopeless struggle to try to be fully ourselves as we sense we should be, and that in point of fact, we are often remote from that. We are often going through motions, or as he puts it, he talks about everything in life being the play, meaning some form of line uttering as opposed to something that's completely authentic. And, you know, I think that is, you know, the truth of life, that not that we are cons with one another, although we are, we obviously are, but beyond that, that in many ways, we are always in search of a true self, and that a lot of our so-called false face wearing, as in Even's case, arises from terrible uncertainty about what really is genuine to ourselves.
Well, this is, in a sense, Robbie's story. What he understands about life is that everyone is incomplete, and that he has within him the capacity to allow them to feel a little bit better. All of his deepest relationships depend upon his helping his wife, who was at first a cocaine addict,
mm-hmm.
To conquer her addiction. There's a heavy and rather religious judge, Magda, whom he sleeps with mm-hmm. mostly because she needs it, or at least in his perception of what such a woman would need, that's his solution. He's trying to give them what they want, and often it is what they want. How did you have the recognition that a liar is frequently not a hypocrite, but someone starved for affection?
You know, I see Robbie as a caretaker who, as you suggest, Michael, recognizes in the hurt and vulnerable an ideal audience to sort of come to appreciate him. And, you know, of course, his genius is that often he means it, and although undoubtedly he never gets enough in terms of affection, he does deliver for people at a certain level, even as, of course, he is often absolutely shamefacedly lying to them, you know, as to his wife, for example, to whom he is dedicated and on whom he cheats relentlessly.
This is Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm. I'm talking to Scott Turow on the occasion of the publication of Personal Injuries. But from its very title, there's a suggestion that the injury is personal. It seems obvious to me, however it may have played out in life, that you, as a writer, you are someone who gives the audience what they are hungry for. You didn't have to be that kind of writer. The profundity of the characters in all of your books strike me that you found the law as a subject and it was ideal, but Graham Greene wrote divertissements and novels that he regarded as being more serious. And so I began again and again not only to identify myself with Robbie, but to identify certain aspects of the author as someone who knows what cards he carries very well and decides again and again that entertainment is the way to reach people's souls.
This was a long process of recognition for me. And I came of age as a writer, particularly during 5 years at the Creative Writing Center at Stanford, during which there were a sort of form of culture wars being played out. At one extreme was Albert Garrard, who led a faction of the faculty who were great admirers of all kinds of avant-garde work. At the other extreme was the faction led by Wallace Stegner, a great realist writer in something of the Dreiserian tradition. Oddly, when I went to law school and when I got into the courtroom, I had my first real encounter with the audience in a way. I had to make sure that I kept 12 people awake in a jury box. And I watched the various stunts and stratagems that were typical of trial lawyers, and I realized that in terms of making universals, there was a single universal force, which frankly neither the dry realists nor the avant-gardists like to talk about much, and that was storytelling. Now, the primacy of storytelling has certainly returned to a lot of literary discussions in the time since I went to law school and started practicing, and that would have been in 1978. But for me in those years, at the end of the 70s, this was a real revelation. And I believed that you could, having tried cases and communicated with a broad, diverse audience, I believed that through storytelling, you could offer what I took, much as Tolstoy, to be, you know, the ideal, which is to say literature that creates a universal, that appeals to a universal audience and informs that audience deeply. For me, You are right. Entertainment is part of the package that, you know, Aristotle's maxim that the purpose of art is to not only enlighten but also entertain is always very close at hand. And I think, just to make one last point, there will forever be a divide between critics and scholars on the one hand and the general reading public on the other. And critics and scholars, no matter how much they enjoy what they're doing, and of course we both know many of them enjoy it profoundly, they are still working when they read. And, you know, people, the general audience that picks up a book late at night or on the weekend or on the beach, they are at leisure. And they are self-consciously not working. And, you know, and there are many, many people out there who find my books work anyway and too taxing and ask too much. So I have not, believe me, I know I have not solved this puzzle completely. But I'm trying.
But where does that put you in relation to a character like Robbie, whose desire on the one hand to satisfy and on the other hand to do a something of a good – there's a deeper nature in Robbie.
You know, absolutely.
He's not a simple
– He is a comforter. He is a nurturer. He is a caretaker. He is a liar. He is he's hard even to discuss in these terms. He's so protean in the way that he does things. But my belief, though, and I want to go back to the jury again for a second. You know, I don't see juries do real well with technical material, patent cases. I mean, they're often out of their depth. But you stare a jury down and ask them to figure out what somebody was thinking or feeling, what they intended. And 12 people off the street know just as much as anybody else about what is really going on with people. And so my theory, and they are engaged in that, and so my theory is that that you can give them a complex character like Robbie and that they will enjoy that encounter.
What I would suggest, because when you talk about critics and scholars versus common readers who read for pleasure, I'm always trying to find my pleasure in a book as if it were, you know, an innocent pleasure, an unselfconscious pleasure. But what that frequently is for me is finding out what makes this particular writer different from any other writer, mm-hmm. and writers who might be considered close to him. So in my case, when I'm reading Scott Turow, what happens to me is that I become aware that I'm dealing with a writer whose question, what is truth, is made complicated by the fact that the law has one definition of it, that storytelling has a very different definition.
Very different.
Right. And what will feel like truth in a story may not actually be true. Then leave aside the law in storytelling, there are the things that people do that are truthful, and then there are the lies that they tell because they want to be true to a deeper truth that they feel about themselves, and that your books are a braiding of these four possibilities. The law, storytelling, what a person is, and what he believes inside himself to be. And that this makes the pleasurable complication for me when I'm reading a book by my guest Scott Turow. Are you consciously working at those levels?
One of the things about this book, I wrote a letter to my daughter while I was working on Personal Injuries when it started to go well. And I said, Rach, I don't know what's going on. I said, I wonder if I've just seen these characters on television. They seem so familiar to me. It just seems to be falling out of me. And it's almost as if it's something that I've seen before. And at many levels, this was the most unconscious I have been as a writer in going through this book. I think that probably the most amazing thing to me is that Robbie Favor is, you know, the ultimate prosecutor's dream, an insider who can go on exploiting the insider's role. And when I was working in the undercover project that gave gave the germ to this novel, one of my assignments was to find such an insider. And I tried, and with a horrible human being, failed. And that entire experience, although it clearly informs this novel, never occurred to me once while I was writing the book.
But really, you see, it's fascinating because one of the classical questions is for philosophers, if you are looking for an honest man, what do you look for? Diogenes,
right.
The search for the honest man. In your case, you're looking for a dishonest man of a certain kind. And what do you look for? A dishonest man with some kind of moral or heroic sense.
Right.
Yeah. It's a very interesting combination.
And of course, a person who is the polar opposite of the person whom, you know, I was working with as a prosecutor, who was, you know, nearly brought me to disgrace, not to mention himself. And it's interesting the way the imagination will sometimes remake things without conscious intervention. And this was certainly an example of that. I mean, I was rewriting what in many ways was a painful chapter in my own life, failing with this guy and getting in trouble because of it, and feeling that I'd done my best and had just been totally bamboozled by this pretty bad person. And yet I remade it in a way where the bamboozler was not reprehensible.
Well, my final question would have to do with heroism, because many critics, at least, have pointed to the origins in detective stories to the myth of Oedipus. They say that Oedipus is not only the first detective in dramatic literature, but the first criminal. He's looking, it turns out, for himself, and the crime he's committed that has brought down a plague on the community is that he has murdered his father and married his mother.
Right.
He doesn't know, in fact, that these people were, in fact, related to him, but he has brought on a moral evil
right.
to the community. By the end of this book, Robbie has become a very complicated kind of scapegoat hero, and he becomes, like Oedipus, the infection that needs to be exiled from the community. And in fact, he is by
yes.
the end of the book. And I wondered, to what degree do your criminals become odd social heroes by being extractable, exilable from the centers of their communities?
Well, there's no doubt that we burden criminality with exactly the emotional baggage that you're suggesting. We keep thinking that if we take these people and throw them in the penitentiary, then we're going to get rid of the parts of ourselves that make us uncomfortable. And of course, the persistence of crime fiction, not only in being written, but in its popularity, tends to suggest that, as many cops on the street recognize, these things are ineradicable in all of us, and that what distinguishes us from those who are exiled for their misbehavior is often precious little, the narrowest tissue of restraint. But I did spend a lot of time thinking about heroism in terms of this book. The prosecutors I worked with in the actual undercover project I regarded as heroes. They were really heroic, and it was a concern to me that in painting a picture of such broad corruption in the legal profession that that people recognize that a character like even truly is heroic, and you're so close to her and so bound up in her mishigas and her confusion and her discomfort with herself that I hope readers don't lose track of the fact that I think she is a true human exemplar and an appropriate one, unlike what we do to our criminals, in the sense that she does believe in duty and fidelity, in of obligation to community, of trying to do the right thing, and she does it, and she grows in the process, and certainly in the classical term, certainly a hero in her own right.
Well, very interesting, because she becomes nowhere more so than when she herself commits what might be interpreted as a murder.
Right.
Almost as if her willingness to expose herself to wrongdoing, even by implication, is what makes her decision, in fact, to do it, is what makes her someone capable of crossing and understanding
right.
the line she's crossing.
Right. No, there's no question about it. And the vacillation and eventually the transformation that takes place in even between her strict morality, where she lectures Robbie at one point about how good and evil are like two sides of the road with a stripe down the middle, and her coming to terms with her own character and the far more complex process of judgment that I think is part and parcel of her being more at ease with herself. And it does involve an embrace of the other side of the road, at least when it's well-motivated.
I've been speaking to Scott Turow on the occasion of the publication of his most recent novel, Personal Injuries, from Farrar, Straus & Giroux. It's been a pleasure to see you again.
It is always a great pleasure, Michael. I really enjoyed this.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Special production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with Book, off the mouse, pop, die.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.